is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
The 20th Party Congress of the Communist Party of China concluded in the middle of October. And now the man who would be king and is emperor and is general secretary and might be president for life, Xi Jinping, is scheduled to go to the world and present his plans, chiefly at the G20 in Indonesia, Bali, within these next days. What is to be expected from the PRC? What is to learn from the PRC's tension with the United States, with Australia, with Japan, and even with Europe? I welcome Gregory Copley, editor and publisher of Defense and Foreign Affairs, publishing most recently about after the 20th Party Congress. Gregory, a very good evening to you. Let me tick off the list of what questions we have about China. The zero COVID policy, indefinitely weakening the Chinese ability to respond to the world's marketplace. At the same time, the sinking GDP, perhaps negative, we can't tell. There's non-transparency, but there's reports of large unemployment, especially among young people. The confrontations in the South China Sea, the East China Sea, unresolved. The aggression towards Australia, unresolved. And the U.S. decision to prohibit the sale and the participation of major chip manufacturing and the intelligentsia attached to it who work in China. All of that is prohibited now for the People's Republic of China, meaning the vision of China 2025 might be a delusion without those chips. So Xi Jinping heads to Indonesia with all that. Is this something he expected? Is he ready to step onto the world stage as the indefinite leader of 1 billion people? Good evening to you, Gregory.
Good evening, John. Well, there's no question that in order to ensure that he emerged from the 20th Party Congress as the paramount ruler for life, if you like, of the People's Republic of China, Xi Jinping literally took the whole of the country into a terminal velocity death spiral to shake off his adversaries. And he pretty much did so, although there's still a lot of them out there, particularly among the, for example, Jiang Zemin faction. So he's still going to be going into a heavy purge period. But really what he has to do now is to blunt the velocity of the implosion, the hard landing, which he caused for the PRC, both economically and socially, so that he can basically keep the country together with him in control. And this is going to be a lot harder to do than starting that intra-party civil war, which he began so that he could seize power. So now he goes on a charm offensive in many ways with his domestic population and also with the world community. And so basically he's trying to, as he goes to Bali, embark on that charm offensive. He did it as well with Olaf Scholz, the German chancellor, who visited Beijing on November the 4th to basically say, look, hey, we're back. We're doing business. Don't worry about it. The reality is that nothing changes the decline strategically of the People's Republic of China. The economy is in terminal decline and will cause many, many internal problems. He has to deal with that. The continued application of the zero COVID strategy is so that he can control the crowds who are becoming increasingly restive. But, you know, the deal which Chancellor Scholz was prepared to do to save a desperate German economy, I likened in my report to a new Molotov-Ribbentrop pact. In other words, when Germany signed the treaty with the Soviet Union before World War II, it was designed with considerable cynicism on both sides, each hoping to gain advantage over the other in their desperate times. And Scholz in Germany was desperate, so he's prepared to seize the last bit of money that he can out of China and the China trade. But the reality is that the purge accelerates within the People's Republic of China as Xi gets rid of his last enemies, if he can, and also to suppress the local population. As you know, the budget for internal security in mainland China is now greater than the budget for the People's Liberation Army, and that's likely to be a continuing feature. But essentially we can expect the G20 meeting to be a further opportunity for Xi to start calming down India, possibly seek some new politeness with Australia, although he seems incapable of turning around the situation which he created in terms of the antagonism with Australia. He's definitely trying to ease the confrontation with Japan. So all of these things are going to play into it. But the reality is that his domestic economic situation is in continued decline. He is still in a power struggle within the country that makes him extremely dangerous. He could push to do something more than just saber-rattling against Taiwan. But he may face opposition from the People's Liberation Army itself, which is by no means certain that they could win a protracted conflict involving Taiwan. And that brings up the whole question, which we can discuss at some time, of the array of new alliances in the Indo-Pacific,
yes,
which are working against
them. I want to go to those, but I first want to pause at the transnational agreements called COP27. There's meeting in Sharm el-Sheikh for the next few days. And this is a continuation of the concern about climate. I understand that. But this is a perception, Gregory, of Xi Jinping. My memory is that the Paris Accords, I think, in 2015, was a dance of like-minded men and women who were congratulating themselves on their virtue of going to renewables, or at least emphasizing climate change in their policy. And Xi Jinping and the Chinese Communist Party got a great deal of attention and applause because they were, and then various metrics, how they were going to convert the country, how they were going to devote resources to renewables at the same time they were going to build the solar arrays and the wind turbines, all of that praise. That is not happening now at COP27. In fact, Xi Jinping deliberately chose not to attend COP27, and there's open knocking of China as continuing to open coal-fired electric generating plants, continuing to burn dirty coal. Has something changed in the world in these last 7 years, or is it Xi Jinping becoming hostile so people push back? Which is it?
Well, I think, as we know, the PRC was always an advocate of the climate change agenda hamstringing his opponents. In other words, he always wanted it to be something which would constrain the economies and strategic development of his adversaries around the world. So it was for Xi Jinping, it was a no loss situation for him to sign up all these treaties, knowing that the PRC had no intention or obligation under them. So basically, he understood that the West would restrict itself, but with legislation and words. And this is the whole theme of the climate change agenda. It's largely about using words as a substitute for, if you like, balanced strategic assessment or empirical scientific knowledge. And so now Xi Jinping doesn't need that anymore. He is in open warfare with much of the world. He has got his strategic alliance structure set up with Russia and with much of the developing world. And he doesn't need the COP27 people at all. And if you look at, for example, the fact that this is being held in Sharm el-Sheikh, it's in the heart of the fossil fuel world, and there is no intention in that fossil fuel world that they should in any way restrict the use of fossil fuels, even though they recognize, as everyone does, that forms of energy are constantly under review and change, whether it's from whale oil to petroleum or coal or whatever. This is a process which is in perpetual evolution, but none of the forms of fuels ever actually goes out of usage.
A note about fuel energy, fossil fuel energy. When the invasion started in February, you were right away pointing out that Russia just saved China. And I want you to explain that again, Gregory, because it's been 9 months, and this has to do with food security and fuel security. How did you see it at the time? What has happened since then?
Well, as we've seen, and as we predicted, the People's Republic of China has been able to replace some Western sources of energy and food by obtaining it from Russia, which was restricted on the world stage by the US-led sanctions. So this was perfect for both countries, and the Russian fuel and foods continue to save the People's Republic of China, giving them both of those commodities at lower prices, and also ensuring that Russia becomes a new and growing market for Chinese manufacturers. The ability of the People's Republic of China to continue to export manufactured goods was going to be very limited unless a new market came on stream, and that new market is Russia. Not satisfactory in the long run, but certainly beneficial. And certainly the People's Republic of China have been providing technologies and weapons and the like to Russia to help bolster it in the Ukraine war. The PRC is always going to be cautious of strengthening Russia militarily, because strengthening Russia militarily also gives Russia the ability to resist the PRC's claims on the Russian Far East, including places like Vladivostok. So it's a love-hate relationship, but currently mutually beneficial. And of course, in the currency arena, the volume of Russian gold, coupled with the lower volume of Chinese-held gold, gives them the ability to start rethinking a joint currency for the Eurasian bloc, which would be gold-backed and be quite stable at that. This is the only way that the PRC is ever going to see the yuan or the renminbi as a tradable international currency. And it would only be because it's backed by substance, namely gold and other stabilizing factors. So this relationship with Russia is extremely opportunistic and beneficial.
I'm speaking with Gregory Copley, Defense and Foreign Affairs publisher and editor. He mentions the confrontation in the Indo-Pacific, and we're going to turn to two versions of transnational agreements. One is called the Quad, another is called AUKUS. And what status do they have now that Xi Jinping has showed his hand as the emperor following the 20th Party Congress? I'm John Batchelor.